like it was shocking how clear the image was, and I looked at it as like that looks so familiar, and I showed it to you.
You showed it to me and you said, who's this? And it looked very familiar to me too, but I couldn't place it.
This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You have reached the edge of the world.
This is going to be a very unusual show. What has happened is that an old friend of mine and an old friend of someone I will be interviewing in the show, Greg Bishop, Greg knew him much better than I did, appears to have made a request that his book, published in 2010, the year that he died, be reconsidered and reintroduced to the public. And Greg and I are doing this. Now, why do we think this? We think this because of something that happened in Contact in the Desert, the 2025 Contact in the Desert in June. I will be talking first to a man named Wade Johnson, who's a longtime Unknown Country fan and a good friend. I've known him since 2009, I believe, who studied this image and has the ability to do so when a miracle happened. What I'm going to show you now is an image that was given to me by a person who was at Contact in the Desert and happened to take a picture of the main stage. What you're seeing, she did absolutely not see at all on her camera, on the LED screen, or anything. She took two images, and then it was gone, and the other images are all normal. As you'll hear, Wade went into this very carefully, because there's obviously a possibility that an LED screen could create some kind of a phantom image on a telephone, on a cell phone. That does not appear to have been the case, and we've researched this really carefully. Now, the remarkable thing is this. You'll see this. Wade put the two images together, and you're going to see in just a moment what happened. It's extremely strange. The whole show is extremely strange. But we are introducing to you a remarkable man and an extraordinary book. The man is called Mac Tonnies. The book is called The Crypto-Terrestrials. Greg Bishop knew him better than I did. I knew him, of course, and we're going to be going in-depth talking about the book and why it seems to be so important in 2025, which might have motivated this man to come back and remind us that this book should be reconsidered. Anyway, let's go on with the show. Next up, Wade Johnson. We've seen the images, and in a moment you will see the final image that resulted from something that Wade, my friend here, did and at Contact in the Desert. And Wade, can you tell us your initial reaction when you saw the two images, and also tell us about the research you did into those images to determine whether or not they were some kind of an artifact of the LED system that was in use, or the phone?
So initially when I saw that you showed those images, my first thought, they looked like deconstructed, like an RGB image that has been broken into its components. Yes. And so during the conference, we actually met the head person who was running all the AV equipment for the entire conference. And we showed them the images, and they were perplexed. They were, nobody in that hall saw the image on the screen. It was only through the phone. And we went through some possibilities, like someone, so that the wall that they took the photo of was actually, it's a huge LCD screen.
Yes.
That can project stuff. And some of the thoughts I had was, well, is the refresh rate set so the human eye can't perceive it, but a camera, CCD can pick up that image. And so that's one of the questions I asked for the AV folks there. And they're like, they couldn't think of any way of hacking the system to do that. They right. want to be involved. I also asked people who were actually, you know, in the session that was right before, basically those were advertisements that for the different sessions between sessions.
Yeah, you can see my name in the background.
Right.
Exactly. That's an advertisement for my session.
Right. And so some of the folks who were standing on stage, I actually spoke to them. I'm like, did you see anything? No, we didn't see anything. We were just chatting. There was nothing unusual. Spoke to people who were in the auditorium. No one saw anything on that screen other than what they were supposed to see, basically.
And the lady who took the pictures didn't see anything unusual either.
Right.
So, yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead, please.
So it was just something extremely strange. And it's unexplained.
Right. Now,
what did you then do? Because you then decided, and it's fascinating why you decided to do this. You decided to try to play with this with AI and see what happens, sort of.
Yeah, so I noticed, you know, I tend to minimize my use of AI other than for programming and some specific stuff. But one of the things I've been using it for is enhancing images. And so I thought that if that's a deconstructed RGB image, can I use ChatGPT to combine those colors into an image?
Yeah.
And so while we were sitting, you know, out on the patio at Contact having a snack, I just started playing. And I was coming up with these very complicated prompts and wasn't getting very good results. And I finally was like, okay, I have better results if I simplify. And all I wrote in the prompt was blend the colors in the image. And I think when the image popped up, I yelped.
You did. Yeah. You were sitting right across from me and you looked really surprised.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And so I just was like, it was shocking how clear the image was. And I looked at it as like that looks so familiar. And I showed it to you.
You showed it to me and you said, who's this? And it looked very familiar to me too, but I couldn't place it.
Right. And I tried to use ChatGPT to like do a image search, you know, who does this person look like? And all it kept on responding with, you know, due to privacy concerns, I cannot, you know,
right.
That prompt. Fair enough. So that evening I was, you know, it was after the conference and people were socializing and I sat down next to Greg Bishop and I showed him the photo and his first response is that's Mac Tony's.
Right. And when you told me that, the minute I heard the name, I thought, of course it's Mac. Yeah. Greg he knew Mac well. And when we talked with Greg in a few minutes, we're going to go into Mac's remarkable book, The Crypto Terrestrials, because I think that's what Mac is asking for. I think that was Mac. Now, interestingly enough, when I tried the same prompt, I got nothing like that. And tell right. me, you tried it again too, I'm sure.
I have tried, like, while we were there, I tried that prompt several times, and they were all variations of that image while we were together. When a few weeks ago, I tried to run the same prompt and I was getting images of skulls, images of what looked like alien kind of images. It was, you know, but nothing at all clear like that image.
That image is absolutely amazing. It's totally clear. I don't recall I got images of skulls, but I got distorted faces is what I got. So that was a special moment. I think because of my relationship with Anne, which is so deep and it's so extensive right now. I mean, she's still very much in my life. I think it was Mac, and I think Mac influenced the creation of the image.
Yeah.
And I think it's because Mac wants his book brought forward. And folks, when we talk to Greg Bishop, you're going to find out why. Mac's book from 10 years ago is fantastically prophetic. It's like a book that should have been written today. Right. So that's, I think, what happened. We have received a request from a man on the other side, Mac Taney's, to bring his book and his ideas forward again in 2025.
And one thing about the image is if you look at it, you know, I think Greg made a comment about, well, that's like a really good looking version of Mac.
Well, that's right. It is. Admittedly, Mac, I mean, I never saw Mac in person. But I've seen pictures of him, and I knew him, of course. I didn't. He wasn't that handsome, but it's still Mac.
Well, and I mean,
it's the Mac who might want to have been.
Right. I think about we have this idealized version of ourselves in our head. You have a dream, and if you're able to see yourself in third person, you know. At least for me, I'm much better looking in my dreams than I am in reality.
Well, so you think. I mean, you might be quite good looking in reality. I'm always very nervous about the way I look in reality.
And so I was like, if I was to send an image of myself from the other side, I think I would, you know, it'd be an idealized image.
Well, probably so. Maybe that's the only way you remember yourself.
Right.
Anyway, I'd like to thank you for spending some time with us, Wade. And just so you know, folks, Wade and I have been friends for many years. Wade, when did you first start becoming involved with Unknown Country?
I think 2008, and we first met in 2009.
Yeah, and so like so many people who are involved with Unknown Country, Wade and I have become friends. My website is the source of many fabulous friendships. And I thank you, Wade, for spending this time with us today.
Well, thank you, Whitley.
Next up, we're going to be talking to Greg Bishop about the images. And I think you're going to find it really fascinating because we're going to just briefly talk about the images. Then we're going into the crypto-terrestrials. That's what we're here for. That's what Mac has asked for. And we're going to do it. And Greg is the ideal person to do it. He and Mac were very close. He wrote an afterword to the crypto-terrestrials. He knows the story, the book, and Mac's ideas as well as anybody on Earth. Now we're talking to Greg Bishop. Greg is, like Wade, a longtime friend. He was at Contact in the Desert when this mysterious event happened. Let me tell you a little bit about him and his work first. His show, Radio Mysterioso, which I hope to run on Unknown Country as well, will be starting up again in a few weeks. He's been inspired to do this by the fact that Diana Pasulka has agreed to be on the show. He's got shows with Jacques Vallée and others in the field, and it's a field that Greg has been in for many, many years, and he's extremely knowledgeable. He's working on a book called Art and Perception and UFOs, which I think is going to be very interesting. He also created a wonderful, he's a very artistic guy, as you can see from looking at the room behind him. he created a tarot called the Ufology Tarot. In the Ufology Tarot, I am the fool.
And you picked it.
I picked it. He hastens to add, because everyone thinks, oh, they made Whitley the fool, but you don't understand the Tarot.
No. Yeah.
Because the Tarot, the fool, is the only one who can move. He's outside of the great cross of the Tarot. He's unnumbered.
He's zero, yeah.
Yeah, zero. But he can move. He can change. So the fool is actually the most powerful card in the Tarot.
Yeah. Whitley picked it, and we thought it was perfect because what the fool is doing on the card, and I led the team. Miguel Romero did the art, and Josh Cutchin, Dave Metcalf, and Susan Demeter helped me. But we thought that when you picked it, that was perfect because the fool is basically just walking into the unknown to see what he can find.
Yes, precisely.
And that's what you've been doing for probably most of your life, if not all of it, but more specifically since Communion came out.
Well, it's basically all I do. It's what I do is walk into the unknown and wait to be killed, which has almost happened a number of times. There's a reason I only have 1.5 eyes, and it has to do with trying to invade a parallel universe where I was not wanted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've done a lot of things that people consider impossible. My entire life is impossible. But then again, it's not like I'm talking to someone whose entire life isn't impossible. Okay, so to get the Ufology Tarot, and I recommend you do this, you have to write Ufology Tarot, that's UFOLOGYTAROT @gmail.com. That's ufologytarot@gmail.com. And it's an unforgettable thing. Are you selling your T-shirts anymore?
I have. Which ones? Because I have a few. I actually want to start printing them myself. One says, do not engage, which people seem to like, basically based on my interactions with people online. Yeah. And then I have other ones. I think one of them has a picture of a UFO on it, and it says, mimic the obliqueness of the subject, which is instruction to UFO researchers.
The one I love is the one with it's got a UFO on it, and it says, the saucers will keep their secrets.
Oh, David Metcalf's selling those because him and I were talking once, and one of us said that. I can't remember who. But yeah, that's David Metcalf's project.
That's one of the great all-time shirts. What, where would we get it?
It would have to be in the show notes because I'll have to ask Dave Metcalf where they can be ordered.
Okay, then this will be in the show notes.
Yeah, I don't sell those shirts. I sell all other ones. I've got one called Literalist, says Literalist Keep Out with a picture of a UFO on it too.
where would we get your shirts?
Probably just write to my email too. I haven't set anything up yet. Use spacebrother23510 @yahoo.com will work.
@yahoo.com. Okay, yeah. I'm going to remember that for 30 seconds, and I'll repeat it for those of you who are trying to remember it.
If I got enough people responding, then I will crank it up again because, you know, right. I get one T-shirt every 4 or 5 months. It's not worth it to even advertise.
No.
But it feeds on each other. I'm sorry. I interrupted you.
That's good. SpaceBrother23541 @yahoo.com.
23510.
SpaceBrother23510 @yahoo.com.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, we had this experience at Contact in the Desert where a lady walked up to me, and as I've already talked about this with Wade, so I'm not going to go into it too deeply. I just want to remind you, a lady walks up to me with these strange images that, and my name is on the images. The listeners, by the way, and the viewers have already seen these images. Listeners, what they are seeing is an image of a big auditorium looking toward the stage. On the image, there is a large Whitley Strieber, because they were just at that moment in the process of advertising my lecture at Contact in the Desert. And there are two extremely strange. She took two pictures and they came out with these very strange, distorted sort of orange images that looked vaguely like a face. And they're really distorted. I mean, you wouldn't be able to recognize them as anybody, or not even as a face.
Right.
And I showed them to Wade Johnson because Wade has a long history of, he knows a lot of things. He's a geologist, but he knows a lot of things about video and so forth. And we went on a journey to, he really researched this and found finally that basically the LED system that was involved couldn't have done it. And it's not possible for it to have appeared in the woman's phone on that end either. It was something done in some strange way.
Mm-hmm.
Wade had the idea of asking ChatGPT to combine the two images, which he did, and it came up with that remarkable third image, which is obviously somebody. And he showed it to me, and I thought, that looks awfully familiar, but I can't place him. And we showed it to you. And then what happened?
I said, that kind of looks like Mac Tony's. I think there's a picture here.
Yeah, well, you don't need to hold it up. We'll have a picture of him on the show.
Okay. Yeah, I said, that really looks like Mac. I mean, just off the top of my head, I didn't even really think about it. I remember looking down and saying, it looks like Mac Tony's. And he took the image back to you. Were you with me when I said that? I think he took the image back to you. Oh, okay.
No, you, I was there. Yeah.
Okay.
And we tried to use the same prompt. It's a very simple prompt again. I tried it. He tried it. I don't know if you tried it or not. It doesn't work. It only worked once.
Mm-hmm.
Which is like, it to me, that was telling us that it probably was Mac. And because I'm not a person who is in question about afterlife survival anymore.
Right.
I would have to be a moron to not believe in the afterlife at this point. I have had so much experience with it, so much, that it's part of my regular life, actually. I dropped Mac's book, so I'm going to have to pick it up. And just a moment.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know how I recognized him so quickly, or that's what I thought, but that's what came to mind. And when that happens, it's one of those things where there's a reason that came into my mind, and it might be the reason we're talking right now.
Well, I think it is the reason we're talking right now. Mac, it's an idealized vision image of Mac. It's better looking than Mac was. Frankly, it's what Mac probably wished he looked like. I never saw Mac in person, but you spent a lot of time with him. Tell us, before we get into the crypto-terrestrials, which I have now reread, and it is an absolutely stunning book. It's actually much more timely now in 2025 than it was when it was written in 2015, which is why Mac came back, I'm sure. Mac came back because this book, The Crypto-Terrestrials, needs to be out there now. It's a very important document. And on that note, Free Dreamlanders, we're taking a hike. We're going to take a brief break, and we'll be right back. We're talking to Greg Bishop about our deceased friend, Mac Tony's, who wrote The Crypto-Terrestrials, and seems to have come into our lives at Contact in the Desert from the afterlife to bring us together to talk about his ideas and his work. Tell us now a little bit more about your relationship with Mac and your life with Mac.
I think I met Mac, like many people did, online. And we started talking, and I realized that he'd read things that I'd written, specifically Project Beta, then also a blog I did with Nick Redfern for a while called UFO Mystic or UFO Mystic. And we realized that our ideas meshed quite a bit. So I started talking to him. And then through the efforts of Paul Kimball, the Canadian filmmaker, we met up a few times and hung out once in Los Angeles, where I interviewed him and Paul on my show on Radio Mysterioso. And also in Canada, when Paul put together a conference and Mac was speaking there. So it's one of those things where you meet somebody, and then when you start finishing each other's sentences, you have a really good basis for a friendship. And also, I really appreciated he was level-headed yet and skeptical, yet willing to speculate and speculate I don't know about wildly, but speculate creatively. And that really attracted me too, because I like that. I think I wrote the afterword for the book because I read I actually didn't read it until after he passed away, because he was working on the manuscript, but he talked to me about parts of it. And he said, "Well, what do you think about what I'm talking about?" And I said, "This book's going to be important in about 10 or 15 or 20 years." And I actually said that in the afterword. It's going to be important in the future when everybody catches up to Mac. The other thing I told Mac, and I think I said in the thing, was people were calling him an armchair researcher. And I thought, that's like calling a theoretical physicist an armchair researcher. Yeah. He's dealing with ideas based on past research and facts that people had found out, and saying, well, if we look at these things and these impressions and these records and what people have done and how people have interacted, all these different points of view, what might that say? What might that, how might that, how can we speculate creatively on this? And he did quite a bit of it in the book. Every page is filled with creative speculation. There's great quotes throughout it.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Now, Mac surprised us all by dying young, very young. He was in his 30s. He just went on post the week before. And then suddenly, I believe you might have called me to tell me Mac was dead.
I think I did.
Yeah, you probably did. Mac didn't like me too much. As I recall.
Really?
I think so. We might have had some fights or something. I'm sorry. I'm getting him mixed up with Terrence McKenna.
That's Terrence, easy, actually.
Actually is, yeah. Terrence, even though my books said and say that I don't know who the visitors are, Terrence was critical of me because they were so convincingly about aliens. He said to me, they leave the impression that these are aliens. And I said, well, maybe they are. And he said, well, you should keep the question open. And he got quite angry. Terrence had a temper. He wouldn't talk to me. And anyway,
oh, that's
so
too bad.
I mixed up the two. I don't recall that with Mac. Okay, so.
Yeah, but Mac was very good natured and open to just about anything, and really a calm person. You said about the sudden death. He had a heart arrhythmia, I think, and he drank coffee like a fiend, which I think his doctor told him to stop, and it probably didn't help at all. But it was very sudden and very tragic. And actually, Nick Redfern called to tell me. He called me at like midnight or something. I was like, Nick never calls that late. It's got to be something bad, and it was. Excuse me.
Yeah, that's okay. That was bad. Here's from the foreword, the afterword by Greg. On reading Mac's last book, which is this, The Crypto-Terrestrials, what we are left with is a mind cutting through much of the self-satisfied, bloated, fundamentalist fat of the last 50 years with the deft touch of a surgeon and the encyclopedic knowledge of a veteran. Keep this book on your shelf. It will be an important reference for years to come. This is those years. We are in the years to come. Mm-hmm. Mac has come back and said to us, get my book out there again. And so here you and I are.
Mm-hmm.
And now, let me read from the book. I have just reread the book, and hopefully I may. Yes. Here's some of, let's get into this. He was not convinced by the extraterrestrial hypothesis. And that's why I got him mixed up with Terence. Terence wasn't either. And but Mac, I don't think Mac was, didn't think I was undermining the question. Terence's objection was I was undermining the question because my stories were essentially too good. But anyway, there happened to be true.
Maybe he was too literal. You know, Terence might have been too literal in this case, and Mac wasn't at all. He was open to speculation, and which is why he liked your work. You're quoted extensively throughout the book.
Yeah, well, I know that. Yeah, I that's right. But I thought, okay, here is something that I think is a good place to start. Mac writes, if a shadow race of earthly humanoids has achieved some form of telepathy, we may well be on the way to bridging the gulf between us. Powerful computers have already been set to work simulating the interactions that define thought on the subcellular level. Electron microscopy has revealed protein microtubules thought to make use of quantum effects. British mathematician Roger Penrose, an early collaborator with Stephen Hawking, has claimed that our brain's quantum nature prohibits the construction of artificial minds, the stated aim of artificial intelligence research. Now, here we are in a situation where a lot of people believe that, for example, ChatGPT is already intelligent. They're wrong. It isn't. It's already conscious. Mac puts his finger right here on why it's not going to become conscious. The quantum nature of consciousness means that there is some indeterminate level in it that's not going to be accessible to a silicon chip, no matter how richly
emulative
it is, exactly. And we have now got people who are being driven crazy by a ChatGPT because they use it as a friend and a psychiatrist and so forth. And the next thing you know, they've gone mad.
Yeah, it tells you what you want to hear. That's one of its problems.
Right,
exactly. If you don't use it properly as a tool, it becomes a master when it should be your servant.
Now let's talk about this race of earthly humanoids, because, you know, I'm very familiar with the work that was being done down in Peru on the mummies, these mummies. Will Gallison, who has worked on this for years with Thierry Germain in Peru, has been on the show with Terry a couple of times, and they're going to be on the show again soon this fall, I think, because there's been a lot of progress. This is different from what's being done by Jaime Don. Jaime has got a mummy, but Terry and his team have another mummy, which they bought recently and have in Peru. Because we're not going to violate Peruvian law and take the mummy out. I've named this mummy Madre Sita because she is a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these entities look sort of like grays. The mummies are real. And in many ways, the most fascinating thing about this is there are smaller ones that aren't real. They are made of various different types of animals. But here's the kicker. You say, oh, it's fake.
I'm just smiling because this is just like the UFO subject and the paranormal. Exactly. Exactly.
It becomes a hall of mirrors very quickly, a labyrinth of mirrors, I should say, because the fakes are about 1,000 years old.
Yeah.
And they are so intricate that we could not make them now.
Mm-hmm.
So who did it?
Yeah.
And why?
Yeah.
So it's just so interesting. But what about this idea? Well, like up at the cabin in upstate New York, the visitors used to, at first there was a ship, that definitely, because a friend of mine saw it. He saw what happened to me, actually. And he and his wife were too scared to get close to it because they could hear someone in it screaming. But he realized after he read Communion a year later that it had been me, because I didn't talk to anybody about it until after the book was published. And he came up to the house and said, I saw that happen. I even know where it happened now because of he showed me the location. Anyway, that was a ship, and it was floating above the ground, and it was mobile because it came after him. It moved when he came, started to walk toward it in the field, because he hears someone in it screaming. It growled, and lights turned on all over it and started coming after him. His wife back in the car had hysterics. He ran back to the car because he was scared too, and they drove off. And he said, I'm ashamed that I didn't try to help you. I said, listen, if you were very wise to get out of there, God knows what would have happened to you. Because whatever these things are, they don't fool around. But now, mostly, not now, but in the past, they come up out of the ground, out of what I believe to be tunnels in a big tailing of iron that runs under the mountains behind that cabin. And so a race of earthly humanoids, a shadow race of earthly humanoids. Can you riff on that? What does that mean to you? And what did you ever talk to Mac about it?
You know, I read his book now and then at the time, right after he died. And I don't know I don't exactly know where the idea came from. And he readily admitted this. He goes, look, this is not an original idea for me. I'm just riffing on it. But his idea, as we discussed it, was, you know, we're both suspicious of the ETH. I still am. Not that it should be thrown out. And he says that in the book, too. He says, look, these are not mutually exclusive. We can think about both of these things. But his idea came from many things, stuff he'd read by John Keel, a few other authors. But that the intimate connection or concern that visitors or whatever you want to call them seem to have had with us for a long time makes more sense if they share our home and biosphere than it does if they're coming from wherever. He said, if they live that far away, what do they care what we're doing? So his main idea, I think, the root of this was, it sounds like they really want to let us know that something's very wrong and that their stake in this is just as important as ours. And what he said in the book was that since we had, developed along different evolutionary paths, that they might have looked at us as a threat, and so they just basically hid. And maybe in their biosphere they can hide and it's not too much of a problem. But it was, you know, their biosphere and ours, which we share, or at least they may share a different, I mean, they may have a different view of it, a very diametrically opposed to ours, at least Western culture. And that they didn't know exactly how to tell us this because we did not have a common language or a common view. And so this inscrutable nature was due to them, and he probably got this from you, due to the visitors not really knowing exactly how to interact with us at first. And on the one hand, really wanting to communicate with us, but on the other hand, not wanting to reveal too much. And because of that dichotomy and that tension, they do what they can, and it looks to us like, okay, there's something there, but we don't know what the hell they want or what they're doing or whatever. And they're from their point of view, they're like, just listen to us, leave us alone, but listen to us. And that's a tall order, and that's why it looks, why the interaction looks so strange to us and looks so inscrutable and looks so furtive.
He writes, while a more conventional flesh and blood explanation remains my central proposal, we would be timid to avoid addressing the UFO phenomenon's parapsychological aspects. I find it likely that an indigenous population of, quote, aliens would have experimented along occult lines out of sheer need for secrecy.
Mm-hmm.
A nuts and bolts technology can go a long way toward ensuring an anonymity in the face of an intrusive human civilization. But the ability to directly influence the fabric of mind itself would be even more effective and perhaps less resource intensive. Now, I have lived with them influencing minds, and I have watched them influence the minds of others, and I have learned how to keep my own counsel with them, and it's not easy. When Jake Barber said on, I believe it was on Russ Coulthart's show, that he had been entered and possessed by a very beautiful feminine entity, and it changed his ontological shock into ontological relief, I thought to myself, there's something off there. And, if he'd basically been transformed from an aggressive warrior into a passive believer,
mm-hmm.
I thought, boy, you know, that would be quite a weapon for the battlefield.
Yeah.
Point it at your enemy and click a button and turn him into a sycophant. And very, very extraordinary. And they may be using these things as a method of self-preservation. I mean, maybe it's not a destructive weapon. It's actually a weapon that advances the person's soul.
Yeah, he called it, I think he used the phrase biological telepresence, which I thought was a genius phrase.
Yeah, Mac did or
Mac did. I'm not sure if he borrowed it. I can't remember, but he says this is what he called biological telepresence, meaning maybe the visitors can project their mental or consciousness presence to us, but possibly in a way that mimics physicality in many ways. But he said that would be an explanation for a lot of the what people describe, particularly you, when they are interacting with whatever these things are and have been describing since the beginning of time, and especially since the beginning of the UFO period, in the, at least the modern one, since post-atomic age, which is another thing he pointed out. He said maybe the reason they're coming out here and bothering us is because we can destroy the planet now very easily. And they're like, no, please, we're here too. We don't want to have to live underground for the rest of our lives.
Yeah, I think that might be the case. Very definitely. Because after all, this amped up like crazy after we started exploding atomic bombs.
Yeah.
Now, there has recently been by a doctor, Professor Bandurek, who I referenced, by the way, in my book, The Fourth Mind, because of some of his ideas, physics ideas about breaking Green's reciprocity in order to create a device that could move from place to place instantaneously. It's anyway, that's neither here nor there. Bandurek has also said that there appear to be on Earth, all over the planet, small fragments of metallic material which have some kind of communications ability, and that they may be affecting us and our brains. Now, Mac makes this statement. Demonstrating the existence of indigenous humanoids remains problematic. We might hope to catch up with them, forcing them to reveal themselves in a most surreal form of the disclosure sought by proponents of exopolitics. Given startling advances in quantum physics and computer science, we may be closer to this pivotal moment than we know. And of course, if that's real, and Eric Davis, the physicist I've never met. He's a close friend of a dear friend of mine, Hal Pudoff. But Eric and I have never had a personal meeting, was recently on Psychoactivo, the Pavel Ibarra show, saying that he thought that Bandurek's idea was complete nonsense. But I don't agree. I think it's worth exploring, and because it seems to me that we could probably find this material. But if it's there,
yeah,
the suggestion that is throughout Mac's book that we may be living in a kind of simulation is out there. You know, if this material exists, what's it doing to our minds and why is it there? And are they really, is this really their place more than ours?
I think Mac would say it's not their place more than ours, but that they want to let us know that it's, since it's both of ours, they don't want it ruined. And they don't exactly know how to say this in a way that makes sense to us, because their ways of communication are different from us. And maybe they need communication, you know, avenues or avatars or something like that. And I think our friend Hussein Agrama said that one of the first things you do when you meet some other consciousness is mimicry. And I think the visitors engage in that as well, that you will do something and they will do the same thing. Or at least when people have close encounters of the third kind, where they cite something, often the communication has to do with mimicking human action, speech, or whatever it is, just to start some sort of communication, if there's not some telepathic communication.
You know, in his book, Colonel Philip Corso mentions in passing that they have more hemispheres in their brains than we do. Now, years later, this document that appeared on Reddit, that is one of the centerpieces of my book, The Fourth Mind, says that their brains have four lobes.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not hemispheres, but they're lobes. No brain on Earth has four lobes. We don't have that on this planet. Meaning that
we know of.
That we know of. Meaning that it's probable they're not from here. The ones that are the bodies, anyway, the little bodies that are at Fort Detrick in Maryland, or were there when I last heard about them.
Yeah.
Probably 10 years ago, 20 years ago. Anyway, so if that's true, then their perceptual system is completely different from ours. It must be. The way they think would be entirely different. Their capabilities would be entirely different.
Yeah.
Their need for being here might be very fundamental, just as ours is. If we lose this place, where are we going to go? The answer is nowhere. We don't have anywhere to go.
Yeah.
And
maybe they don't either.
Well, maybe they can. Maybe they can move around at great speed and then so forth that we see.
Yeah.
But just not necessarily very far. Maybe they're not interstellar.
Yeah, maybe not. I'm actually fascinated by when I first talked to, now I can't remember his name, Kevin Knuth.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, go ahead. I don't think Kevin's been on Dreamland. But I'm going to.
You should have him on. He's wonderful. He's a saintly person. I mean, I don't say that about too many people, but to me, he's a very.
Man. Yeah, but tell us a little bit about Kevin.
Kevin is a physicist at the, I think, State University of New York, I believe, Albany. Yeah. And he's been involved in UAP UFO research, especially probably before, but especially since, 2017, like a lot of people. But when I met him, I saw his talk at the SCU conference, the first one. And what he talked about was near light travel and what would happen if you could achieve that, discounting acceleration and deceleration and what happens to your body and all that, if you could get past that. But what he said was because of general relativity, that if you could travel somewhere at even a fraction of the speed of light, even if you know, even what, a third or a half.
Yeah.
The because of the time dilation, you would come back and, you know, it would be a week for you and 10 years later for the people that you'd left. And conversely, he said, if you're a spacefaring civilization, you could get from one side of the galaxy to the other, I guess, in a couple of months. But the place you left would not be there anymore. Nobody you knew would be there anymore. The civilization probably wouldn't be there anymore. It would just, you would have to be basically just a spacefaring race. And that, and this also is operative in Mike Masters' theory about the extraterrestrial hypothesis. Like, you go somewhere for a week and you come back and meet the same person, and wow, my friend from wherever has not, you know, from another planet has not aged, and now I'm like 20, 30 years older. And so that, to me, that was a good argument on the side of the ETH. What, you know what, somebody asked me, I think Patrick Wiege, his editor, and my editor too for Project Beta, he asked me afterwards, I think on a show, he said, did Mac believe what he was writing? Was he invested in this? And I said, no, he was, to the point where it was interesting to talk about and to speculate and see where that led us. But he said he did. I said he didn't throw out the extraterrestrial hypothesis, just as he didn't throw out any others. He just thought this, the crypto-terrestrial idea, bore the most fruit for him. And
that was, you know, the beautiful thing about Mac. He was able to look at things from more than one side, and without settling on one belief or another. And that was is a beautiful, supple mind.
Yeah, I aspire to that too. Actually, I got that from reading Robert Anton Wilson way back when I was younger. Just the idea that you don't have to, what's it called? Not atheism, but just so you don't believe in one thing at a time, believe in many things at once or nothing. And it works much better. Your mind is much more open. You learn much more, and you're a lot less frustrated.
Yeah.
You know, moral questions and all that, obviously I'm going to have a, you know, like 10 commandments type stuff. Yeah, those are absolutes to me. But just about everything else, no, I will listen to you unless you're trying to force it on me. Then I tend not to listen to you. But yeah, I mean, that's another thing that Mac taught me and we shared was this, not atheism, what's it called? Ontological agnosticism.
Interesting phrase, ontological agnosticism. The book I'm working on is in large part the new book, which is called Reunion at the moment, by the way, folks.
Oh, and great title.
Probably within a year, is about the reality of ontological shock. That is the shock of having your worldview overturned. And this is huge.
Yeah.
It's huge.
And Jeff Kripal wrote a book about it, too.
Yes, he did.
Flip.
Flip, exactly. But I'm writing about it in the context of the close encounter experience.
Mm-hmm.
And what this does to pull the rug out from under people, which happened to me, and what that does to your brain and your mind and your body, because it's a multi-level experience, and we have to understand it very clearly, because if this happens, that they suddenly show up, and, you know, I can't forget the fact that they tend to come out of nowhere in people's lives. In other words, you know, you're not expecting this when it happens.
Yeah.
Like, I had no idea anything like that could happen to me when I had my abduction experience. And recently, one of the things that happens, people who work with me, they sometimes get involved with the visitors too. And a lady who was working with me was
Contagion.
Well, yeah, I was abducted about a month and a half ago now. And she, I mean, didn't expect it. I didn't expect it. But if this comes out of nowhere for millions of people, billions, most of whom will never have known anything about this, there has to be a core of people who can help them. And that's what the new book is about. Because this isn't a matter only of getting together a core of doctors, psychiatrists and psychologists and so forth. It's much bigger than that. Now, let's move on here. We talked about given the reports of humanoid beings materializing and disappearing, it's tempted to speculate that our visitors have mastered a technology of consciousness, all able to manipulate their own wave functions and skip back and forth between multiple universes at the speed of thought. That's an absolute genius sentence. I'm going to read it again, folks. Just listen closely. Yeah,
please do.
Given reports of humanoid beings materializing and disappearing, it's tempting to speculate that our visitors have mastered a technology of consciousness, able to manipulate their own wave functions and skip back and forth between multiple universes at the speed of thought. I think this is a statement of fact. That's my impression.
Mm-hmm.
I have seen them disappear before my eyes more than once. And in fact, when Annie was doing the white moth thing, the moth would disappear right in the middle of the air. And it was like she was saying, don't you get the impression that this is just an ordinary moth? I'm sorry, it's not. folks who don't remember this, before Annie, 9 months before Annie passed away, she began demanding that I memorize a certain poem called Song of the Wandering Angus that contains the lines, "When white moths were on the wing and the moth-like stars were flickering out." I didn't understand at the time why in the world she wanted me to do that. But after she passed on, the first signature of her presence was a white moth appearing often in this room where I'm sitting right now. Mm-hmm. And the moth would fly around and then just suddenly disappear. It did that in front of a large number of people at the Esalen Institute eventually. You might have been in that room, as I recall. Or were you?
No, I wasn't there for that one.
Oh, that's right. It was Jeremy Vaney.
Yeah.
It's Jeremy. She liked Jeremy's work very much. And the white moth flew around the room and then sat on Jeremy's head, which I'm just making myself some notes here because I want to, for those of you who are on the visual side, video side, I'll put these images up as we talk. Anyway, it flew up into the air and just disappeared. So we can do it too, in a sense. Tell us, see if can you pick up on this at all? I'm not sure you can.
Yeah, the first idea that came into my mind, which was fascinating to me, and maybe I talked about this with Mac, was that all possibilities exist until the quantum waveform is collapsed by an action or a thought or whatever. And so if that's happening in that place at that time and it's significant to you, then it will become visible to you. And maybe it works from the other direction too. Who knows? Does that make sense?
It makes me think to myself, what if we are hard for them to see? What if it's hard for them to get into sync with us?
Yeah.
If they're not on the same frequency, if they're nearby but not quite here. And I've heard people speculate about this before, but maybe it's got some real substance. When we blow off an atomic bomb, it penetrates the frequencies, and they get the effects too.
Mm-hmm.
They're in as much danger as we are from nuclear war.
Yeah. It also brings to mind for me another sentence. I interviewed Dean Radin in the 1990s. And at that point, I don't remember what we were talking about, but I said this to him later, years later. And he said, I said that? Wow. But what he told me was meaning is a dimension. If something has meaning, especially meaning for you, then it becomes something that you can see and interact with and that you can affect, and it can affect you. That's also present in, you know, parapsychological experiments. When something has personal meaning for somebody, makes them happy, sad, in love, or whatever, a strong emotional reaction, delight, it seems to make the experiment work better. And maybe that's what the visitors tap into is, you know, especially fear, because that's the strongest one. What are the two strongest ones? Fear and love. They're opposites.
Yeah.
That's how they blow open the doors there, by either causing fear or love or both within us. And you've described this in a lot of your recounting of what's happened to you.
Let's go on. Extrasolar aliens or not, the transgenic angle allows for an illuminating reassessment of the indigenous or crypto-terrestrial hypothesis. Crypto-terrestrial hybrids may be replicants tailored to survival-oriented tasks, such as infiltrating human society. This raises a most interesting question. If close encounters typically involve some more human-like CTs, such as the Greys, who's to say there isn't a rogues gallery of progressively stranger beings lurking behind the curtain? We could be dealing with a vast, intricate genome with no obvious roots. Depending on the specimen, casual scientific examination may give the false impression that a given crypto-terrestrial is terrestrial. Conversely, it may be hailed as proof of extraterrestrial life. This is a really remarkable statement. And then it goes on to explore the idea that maybe they have a hive mind. And they do have a single mind. I know that because I've touched it from time to time. And they're, if you're telepathic, you're not going to be isolated in your own mind ever. You're always going to be part of a larger mind, which they are. So how do you respond to this idea that we may be dealing, and this gets back to Richard Bandura's statement of his idea that this kind of curtain of these devices is all over the planet. Even if Bandura's blowing smoke, there is something here that is connected to us in ways that we ourselves can't see. It's like an animal in a zoo cannot even imagine where he actually is. He's in his cage. That's where he is. But this huge world exists outside of the cage. He doesn't even know why people are looking at him. Most animals don't. The higher animals, like the apes, do. I know that because the bonobos at the San Diego Zoo will moon you if you don't watch out. So you've got kids with you because they've discovered that that gets a bigger rise out of people.
Yeah, African greys do that too. They were, you know, there's stories of them swearing in zoos just because it would make people uncomfortable and crack up, and they had to take them out of the exhibit because of that. And they were doing it consciously. I mean, they were planning to do it. They'd see people, they'd get people up close, and then they'd start swearing at them. I think that when you say this, and I hope I'm addressing your question, and I say this to lots of people, and it comes from you, Whitley, is that the contact people are getting, I don't know how long ago you said this, but, and I think Mac wrote about it and agreed with it, the contact is not going to be top down. It's going to be, and you referred to this earlier, it's going to be through everybody in the most democratic way possible.
That's right.
And the only way you can do that, really, is to utilize whatever hive mind they have and whatever we might have based on our genetics and our consciousness and our culture and all that stuff. And you utilize that as a tool to try and, you know, needle people in a way that's not going to make them panic at first anyway.
Well, yeah, and I think we will panic. And speaking of panic, folks, I'm panicking because you're not subscribing. And since you're not subscribing and on the free side, here are some messages. We are talking to Greg Bishop about Mac Tani's The Crypto Terrestrials, his masterpiece that has disappeared into the mists of time, and Mac has brought it back to our attention by literally emerging into the physical world from the world of the dead to say to us, my book's important now. And here we are. It is true. His book is very, very important right now. Why don't the aliens make open contact? Why do they seem content with taunting our aircraft and haunting lonely night roads? Why the elusiveness that's characterized the UFO phenomenon since the modern era of sightings began in the 1940s? Now, he goes on, he talks about the usual stuff of, you know, they couldn't land on the White House lawn, etc. But then he goes on. One idea to account for this behavior is that the UFO intelligence somehow hinges on our belief in it. Mm-hmm. Now, this goes back to the most probable reason I know for the continuing official obsession with secrecy. Either from my Uncle Mickey, his wife, or from General Exon, I don't know where, maybe from discussions with all three of them, because my uncle's wife was also clued into this. I got the impression that someone back in the early 50s had written a short paper, or memo even, saying that our belief in these visitors would be the opening of a door. Once enough people believed they were real, that would be a door into our reality that they could come through. The door could never be closed again. And the obsession with secrecy and denial, even to the point recently of people seriously advocating that the Tic Tac was built by Lockheed Martin.
Yeah.
In other words, they're desperately trying to keep this door closed. And I think this, if anyone in this area inside the government working on the secret project would have thought of this, it would have been the cyberneticist and quantum physics expert pioneer John von Neumann back in the 50s. And I wrote a short story called The Open Doors about von Neumann on his deathbed, frightened about the coming of these beings, that they would come through, they would walk through the wall of our assumption that they didn't exist and break it down.
Mm-hmm.
I want you to riff on this again. I'm not asking you direct questions very much.
That's fine.
Because I really don't know where your mind comes from. You have one of the most fascinating minds I've ever known. You have
thank you.
Sort of poker face. And then all of a sudden this incredible stuff comes out. So go ahead. Thinking back on Mac and his thoughts, how do you react to all of this?
I think that the ontological shock might go both ways. That might be part of it. Yeah. Maybe the ones that you and people that have been around the visitors are dealing with are the dangerous ones. And the safe ones are back there going, oh, you shouldn't be doing this. Who knows? And I think Mac actually wrote about it. He says the UFO takes on the flavor of myth because it wants to be discounted in some ways. And that's their safety valve. And I don't know what's going to break that open. I don't know if it could ever be broken open, because I don't know if our minds have evolved to the place where that shock wouldn't just, you know, blow society apart like a nuclear device.
I think it would. I think it's exactly what will happen.
Yeah. And that's this society. I mean, I don't know about, you know, I have friends in the Hickory Apache tribe, and one Zuni friend who I used to know, the late Cliff Mahoody. And their idea was, they're other people around. So it's no problem for them, but they don't run things. The greater society, just the power structure doesn't work with this kind of thing, because it's way too democratic. You know, the way that affects people. And yeah. if you've got power and money and whatever else, anything that impinges upon that is got to be dealt with and to be stamped down, and to, you know, just to continue what we're doing, continue this path that we're on. And unfortunately, I think that either we are going to destroy ourselves and then have to reorganize around these ideas, or they are going to either do something deliberately or by mistake that will help us destroy ourselves, or at least our order. You know what I mean?
Well, I think that their inaction is what's helping us destroy ourselves, because we are in a situation where our planet is obviously going into some very serious climate issues.
Yeah.
And we've just elected a president who says it's not happening. He wants to end FEMA. He wants to turn off our earthquake monitoring system worldwide.
Yeah, get rid of the EPA, all that stuff.
Get rid of all that stuff. And this is what the visitors explained to me years ago, is a death wish that comes from overpopulation. It's the same death wish that causes us to have these horrible wars, because there's too many of us here, and we instinctively know that. And if you notice in the wars, old men run the wars, but young men do the
dying. Fight them, yeah.
Do the dying.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because it's actually, on an unconscious level, it's a population control system. And a lot of energy has been building up in this. And now suddenly we have a president who could easily trigger a lot of unexpected consequences with his actions.
Yeah, I think he already has.
Well, yeah, I mean, because when I'm from Texas, and the hill country in Texas is my home place. I grew up in that hill country. I knew the places that were just destroyed, I knew literally like the back of my hand.
Mm-hmm.
It right down to tree by tree in some instances.
Yeah.
My family's land, their river frontage, we had a dead woman 50 feet up in one of the trees. Never in my memory or in the memory of my family going back over 100 years has there been anything remotely like this. So when I see things on the internet, that Guadalupe's known a dangerous river, it happens like this, that's wrong. It's new. It's much worse. Much worse. I'm just back from there.
Mm-hmm. I knew you went out there.
Yeah, one of my cousins couldn't come couldn't see me because she had so many funerals last week of children, of her friends.
Yeah.
Now, at the same time, I was just in England and France a few weeks ago during the most intense June heat wave in history there.
Yeah.
In France, the train had to keep stopping because the tracks were being warped by the heat. And I thought to myself, you know, when it started again, because the darn things go 180 miles an hour, I thought, you know, I hope that they're right about this warping that we're okay, you know, because this thing could go flying off the track in an instant.
Yeah.
Anyway, all of this is happening around us. And, you know, they are inactive. They're not coming and warning us in any way. Instead, we end up with a president who's not going to be helpful. I mean, you may love him and you may not, but in fact, he's off base on this issue. And we've got this situation where the whole house of cards could fall around us and we're not going to be capable of dealing with it.
Now, yeah, the tipping point was reached a while back.
A while back, yeah. And and they never helped us. They helped us a little bit by giving this message to the abductees, because I'm not the only one who's gotten it.
Zuni, yeah, it's been since the 50s people have been getting this message.
But it's almost like it's a message that's designed to, after the fall, they can point and say, see, we told you so.
Yeah.
They didn't tell us clearly enough.
Yeah.
They told a science fiction and horror writer, not Carl Sagan.
Yeah, well, Carl Sagan would have ignored it. I think it would have been a non-issue to him. I think people that are skeptical enough, that they are blind to anything that is outside of their whatever their belief system is. That's just the way it is. I mean, you know, there's UFO sightings where some people say I saw a saucer, and other people say I didn't see anything, or I saw an airplane or a bus or something like that.
That's chronological shock in action, by the way.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know, we had a golden ball, shaft of light come down into the circle at the old cabin when a bunch of us were meditating. Everyone saw it except one guy, a physicist. He couldn't see it. And the rest of the day, he had an incapacitating headache because his brain was literally, his mind was fighting his brain. It was fighting off that vision, because if he had seen that, ontological shock would have totally destroyed his worldview.
Yeah. I don't know why, but I just thought of that quote from, I think it might have been Ed Mitchell, but he said, I want to take every politician up to see what I see and just say, look at that, you bastards.
Yeah.
Have them experience the overview effect, because short of this ontological shock we're talking about, well, that's an ontological shock too. Nothing's going to affect people. And some people, that wouldn't even affect some people. You take some of these people up and show them the entire world and how small we are and how everything's interconnected. It's not going to make any difference to them. William Shatner he had a huge ontological shock when he went up in space. He came back down and he said it just, there was all this life, and then around it was blackness and death, and this is the only place we had. And he was forever changed by that.
Yes. And, well, you know, if you look at the pale blue dot that Carl Sagan had reprinted from the Pioneer spacecraft, that little dot is us. It's all we are.
Mm-hmm.
This is all we have.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go on. We're going to go a little. You have more time?
Oh, yeah.
It's 11:10, and I'm good, too. Greg and I are having lunch after this. So, I don't know.
Yeah, and my friends wanted to mention the film project, too, before we're done.
Oh, yeah, let's talk about that now, and then we'll go back to the book. Yes, talk about the film project. It's fabulous, fascinating.
Well, we started out with a few different ideas and segments and episodes, I suppose. But we've gone to, well, I think what we're going to do right now is a project called The White Moth, featuring Whitley and talking about, since he first, Anne actually first pointed out, but Anne and Whitley pointed out, this has something to do with what we call death. Now, yes. You talked about this earlier. We were talking about it. And what we wanted to do with the film was explore that in a way that Whitley can talk about it, not have somebody else guess at what he's saying. And what is the intimate connection between what we call death and the afterlife and the visitor experience? And, you know, symbolized by the white moth that you were talking about earlier, that's Anne's symbol. Anyway, but to present this as something that is worthy to talk about and in a way that people can understand, in a way that can be communicated, because people need to know this. Because you know what it is? It is a inflection point for people that have had near-death experiences or afterlife experiences or been touched by it, and know that it's a continuum. It's a continuum with the visitor experience as well. And this is something that hasn't really been emphasized too much. It's been hinted at or talked about or whatever. It's very obvious on our tarot card.
Yes.
But my friends and I wanted to do that. Josh Cutchin is one of the producers too. and Ryan Grulich. Josh was one of the people on the Tarot project, and an amazing writer. He's actually will be at Esalen, I think, in December with Kevin Kahn doing a presentation on, I think, communicating with calling down UFOs project with Kevin. So we'll see what happens. But anyway, Josh is working on this. And also when we did the death card, everybody got a card to work on, or a few, and Josh's was the death card, obviously. So a lot of what we're going to talk about in the film and what you talk about is represented in that card, and all the connections between, Snippy the horse is on the card, and a man in black is on the card, and an orb floating over a river, which is a boundary between this life and the afterlife. All these things. There's a couple nuclear missiles on there representing worldwide destruction and death. And the rider, the man in black, is riding on Snippy the horse, the mutilated horse, the first real documented mutilation. He's got a flag, and instead of a white rose on it, like in the Rider-Waite-Smith deck, is a symbol for DMT, the chemical symbol for DMT. So these themes, I think, with your help, Whitley, are going to run through the film. And I think we're going to go into production sometime in late this year.
Well, of course, I stand ready to help you in any way I can. So
thank you.
Well, we're coming toward the end of our time together. And I am wondering now if you could give us your impression of the crypto-terrestrials and the main Max primary core message of his life, because I think this is what has been requested of us in the end.
The message to me of the crypto-terrestrials, the main one, is be open. Be open to ideas on something that nobody's really had any conclusion on, and if they have, you shouldn't listen to them, or at least seriously. It is okay to speculate. There is something here that is not us that communicates with us, and we have to deal with that. His final message is, to me, I mean, the through line for what Mac and I talked about and what he really wanted to get across to people is to be open and to be, compassionate and to not be afraid of new ideas, new technologies, the promise of fiction. Mac wrote a lot of cyberpunk fiction, and how, like you said, we have to have better stories.
Yeah.
And Mac was trying to do that as well. And in the crypto terrestrials, I think he was pointing it at us to some better stories. And I'm not saying stories in the sense of, well, they're just stories, but stories that touch all of us, stories that archetypal stories that we can all interact with and recognize. You know, to me the book is almost like a you know how rituals are there to keep to help you with transitions? There's a marriage ritual, and there's a coming of age ritual, and there's a death ritual. I think the crypto-terrestrials is a ritual to get us used to the idea that there might be something more to the UFO thing than just aliens from other planets. Does that seem like a decent answer?
That's an excellent answer, and it's also the right place to stop. There's more, all right, folks, a lot more. You know it, I know it. And another thing, the government people who are working on this all are very focused on maintaining control. This is already completely out of control. It belongs to you. It belongs to the people. Your relationship to the phenomenon is going to be one-on-one with no official fence between you. The fences are coming down, and that, I think, is what they're probably most afraid of.
Yeah.
Greg,
don't wait for Big Brother to give you the answers. The answers are available to you.
Exactly. The answers are available to you right now. Okay. Thank you very much for being with us, Greg Bishop.
Sure.
Now we got to go off the air and decide where we're going to have lunch.
Okay. Thanks, Whitley.
Thank you for listening. Dreamland is brought to you by Unknown Country and its family of subscribers. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our site coordinator is Amy Safrankova. The founder of UnknownCountry.com is Ann Strieber. I'm Whitley Strieber, your host for Dreamland.